to raid rice caches in Laos. The NVA secretly purchased rice from the Sihanouk government. It was no small-scale enterprise. North Vietnam bought 55,000 tons of rice annually from Sihanouk, plus another 100,000 tons from Cambodian farmers. 62,000 truckloads of rice, without running the Laotian gauntlet of air attacks and SOG ambushes and raids. Each truckload of rice purchased in Phnom Penh allowed the NVA to fill another southbound truck on the Ho Chi Minh Trail with rockets, ammunition, and grenades to kill Americans. Sihanouk also secretly opened his country's major seaport, Sihanoukville, to clandestine arms shipments. Though they lacked proof, already by 1966, MACV's senior intelligence officers estimated 1,000 metric tons of Chinese military hardware had slipped surreptitiously through Sihanoukville to enemy sanctuaries on Vietnam's frontier. MACV Commander General Westmoreland found himself at odds with Johnson administration officials who refused to criticize Sihanouk because they hoped to woo him from Hanoi. After Lieutenant General Stanley Larson, commander of U.S. forces in central South Vietnam, told reporters the enemy was operating from the safety of Cambodia, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara declared the evidence insufficient. When reporters went back to General Larson for clarification, the chagrined officer could only smile and say, "I stand corrected." In early 1967, both General Westmoreland and Admiral U.S. Grant Sharp, Commander-in-Chief Pacific CINCPAC, urged that SOG be authorized to infiltrate recon teams into Cambodia. Washington's political process finally shook it all out in May 1967, and Project Daniel Boone was born. SOG was off to Cambodia with the State Department's grudging authorization, according to Chief SOG Colonel Jack Singlob, and with restrictions tighter even than on SOG's Laotian prairie fire operations. Daniel Boone meant penetrating the territory of an unsympathetic regime, so Washington demanded deniability, absolute deniability. Under no circumstances were SOG teams to be given tactical air support. It was better to lose a whole recon team than have one F-4 Phantom documentably bomb Cambodia. If an American was captured, just as in the popular show Mission Impossible, the U.S. government would disavow his actions, perhaps even declare him a deserter. As in the early Shining Brass days, all weapons and gear would be of foreign manufacture and unattributable to the United States. The SOG teams would be limited to gathering intelligence. There would be no offensive actions, no ambushes, no mining, no raids. And SOG could engage the enemy only for genuine self-defense, because SOG recon men might mistake Cambodian soldiers for NVA. Both carried AK-47s and wore plain green uniforms. "That's why we had to be so careful," First Sergeant Billy Greenwood explained. "You'd be trailing a bunch of people and you weren't sure if they were Cambodians or North Vietnamese." Only to take prisoners could SOG men initiate contact, and then policy limited it to isolated groups of two or three VC-NVA. Helicopter gunships were the only aerial support authorized, and they could fire only in self-defense or to help a team break contact, using machine guns and rockets. No incriminating bomb craters were to mar Cambodia's countryside. Daniel Boone operations initially were targeted into Cambodia's thickly jungled but heavily occupied northeast, adjacent to South Vietnam's central highlands. The first Cambodia penetration came off without serious blunder, but the second mission, executed on 5 June 1967, was described by the Recon 10 who led it, Sergeant First Class Lowell Wesley Stevens, as "the longest day in my life." Inserting by unmarked King B helicopter on a heavily forested ridge that jutted 100 yards into Laos, 10 Stevens, his assistant team leader Sergeant Roland Nuki, and four Nongs dashed up a steep slash-and-burn LZ into the jungle, only to hear voices and signal shots. They'd been spotted. Instead of spending 5 days sneaking eastward in search of two roads, several enemy base camps and disordered artillery positions, they could only hunker down and hope for the best. NVA were converging all around them. Setting aside his suppressed Swedish K submachine gun, Stevens took up the radio handset and reported, "We've got bastards all around us. Request immediate extraction." In most situations, that would have been enough. But there was an inexperienced SOG major with the FAC overhead. In fact, the officer wasn't Special Forces qualified, wasn't even airborne qualified, had no combat time, and would never have had his job but for high-level bureaucratic inanities. The ignorant major thought Stevens was crying wolf and would not turn the King Bee around to retrieve the team. He wanted more proof. Stevens heard NVA leaders shouting to their soldiers, herding them uphill into advantageous firing positions. Technically, Stevens and his men belonged to Project Omega, which on paper was a 5th Special Forces Group organization. The 5th SFG's Projects Omega, Special Forces Detachment B-50, and Sigma, Detachment B-56, were formed supposedly to recon remote areas in South Vietnam, but actually, they represented an attempt by 5th Group's senior officers to wrest Cambodian cross-border operations away from SOG. Correctly anticipating that Project Daniel Boone would be approved, the group's senior officers formed Omega and Sigma in hopes of winning the Cambodia project. Instead, the Joint Chiefs transferred Omega and Sigma to SOG. Caught in the middle were dozens of Green Beret recon men like Lowell Stevens, who didn't give one damn about bureaucratic rivalries, but had to deal with the fallout, such as this incompetent major. At Stevens' urging, the major finally had 4 American Huey gunships strafe the woodline around the slash and burn, and when they didn't draw ground fire, the cocksure officer was convinced Stevens was running scared. With disgust in his voice, the major radioed, "Okay. Send in a helicopter, and we'll call it a day." Because the slope was so steep, the King Bee that went in carried an American to help lift the recon men aboard. A tall, lanky Master Sergeant, Ben Snowden. Friendly, quiet, and a good soldier, Snowden was an old Vietnam hand and well-respected, and it was his welcome hand that reached from the hovering King Bee above Stevens. Just as Stevens lifted up his Nung Point man to Snowden, "They're let loose such a volume of fire as I've never heard since," the 10 said. While the men on the LZ jumped for cover, the chopper rocked groggily back and forth but somehow lifted away. The King Bee made it back to SOG's Dak To launch site where, riddled with 68 bullet holes, its engine out, it slammed into a ditch. From his cover, Stevens raised his head, looked uphill, and for the first time could discern a gully and a cave. Protruding from the cave was the NVA machine gun that had hit Snowden's King Bee. It had ceased firing as soon as the helicopter left. Now Stevens realized they were after the helicopters. They didn't want us. They could have got us on square one. They could have shot me sitting in the door coming in. Fortunately, Stevens and his men were not actually in Cambodia, but 100 yards into Laos. Covey brought in a pair of A-1s that dropped bombs and strafed danger close, forcing the enemy back. A King Bee made a few low passes and didn't take fire, so it swung around and touched down, and the whole recon team rushed it and jumped aboard. It was about 30 feet in the air when that NVA machine gun reappeared at the cave mouth, and its concentrated fire shot the tail rotor off, spinning the bird wildly around until it flipped and slammed in on its side, its shattered rotors flailing the earth, kicking up a momentary dust storm. Inside the crashed King Bee, Stevens lay among a mass of rucksacks and squirming bodies. Despite his daze, he saw high-octane gas streaming everywhere, and he knew any second it would torch up. He jumped up, grabbed the edge of the open doorway and pulled himself out. Sitting atop the H-34's side, he could make out 3 NVA and the machine gun that had brought the King Bee down. Whether awestruck or compassionate, the communist gunners stopped firing for a few seconds. That was all that Stevens needed. With adrenaline inspiration, he snatched up his Nungs and the Vietnamese door gunner and heaved them like rag dolls to safety. Meanwhile, his 1-1, Roland Nuki, ran around, kicked in the cockpit plexiglass and dragged the pilots out. Amazingly, not one of the 9 men was dead, and only the Vietnamese door gunner's wounds were serious. As they low-crawled into the jungle, the machine gun resumed firing, but by then Stevens had arrayed everyone securely in a small perimeter. But they had to be extracted soon or they were doomed. Only one flyable King Bee remained, and it had to leave to refuel. To make matters worse, Covey, too, went to refuel. The only air support left was an unarmed bird dog carrying recon man Joe Woods. The bird dog made simulated gun runs to keep the enemy occupied. But it was a propeller-driven A-1 Sky Raider from the Pleiku-based SPADs that saved the day. While the King Bee and Covey refueled, Stevens carefully described to the A-1 pilot the exact heading to the cave containing the deadly machine gun. Then the A-1 rolled in, banked almost vertically to release a shiny canister that spun end over end just above the team, smashed through limbs and leaves, bounced once, then spewed 50 yards of jellied gasoline into the small cave mouth, and phoomph! The napalm flashed brackish orange. Scratch one machine gun. Looking up at that sharp-shooting Sky Raider, Stevens saw what looked like dust flicking off its skin, and realized other enemy machine guns were stitching it with slugs. A second later, the plane belched smoke. Stevens watched the A-1 nose up, saw the canopy fall away and the pilot eject. Stevens clenched his Swedish K so hard it shook in his hands, but wishing and hoping were no help, the parachute drifted into the NVA positions. The A-1 pilot was lost. Whether he died in captivity or was killed immediately, Stevens never learned. Momentarily, helicopters appeared, gunships, and the remaining King Bee, flown by the Vietnamese pilot who'd taken 68 hits and crash-landed the other bird at Doc To. He had insisted on flying because he knew the LZ. With the deep shadows of sunset falling across the hillside and this one final H-34 available, everyone understood there'd be just one chance. The gunships let loose almost their entire loads in a couple of withering low-level passes. Then came the King Bee. It seemed anticlimactic after 6 hours of shooting and bombing and strafing, but they got out with only minimum ground fire. At Doc To, Stevens and Nuki and the Nungs climbed from the King Bee, exhausted and sweating, but euphoric because their team had come through without losing a single man. Stevens lifted a silent toast to the unknown A-1 pilot. Then Lowell Stevens saw a body bag and learned Ben Snowden was dead, riddled by 9 of those 68 bullets that hit the first King Bee. He'd probably died even while he hovered 6 feet over Stevens on the LZ. In honor of the lanky Master Sergeant, about 100 SOG men gathered that night and sang Hey Blue. In memory of this first man lost in Daniel Boone, they named the new recon company office at Con Thum, Snowden Hall. Within a few months, the SOG teams penetrating Cambodia had proved their worth. The new teams discovered dozens of enemy trails, roads, phone lines, base camps, and caches. For the first time, U.S. intelligence could assemble a comprehensive picture of where the NVA were in Cambodia and what they were doing. Cambodia's extreme northeast, which protruded like a 30-mile peninsula between Laos and South Vietnam, may as well have been North Vietnamese territory, the NVA so heavily dominated it. In this dense rainforest, the NVA did anything they wished, and their roads secretly networked with the Laotian Ho Chi Minh Trail. Down around Highway 19, opposite South Vietnam's city of Pleiku, there began a zone 50 miles long, so devoid of water that SOG troopers called it the wasteland. Unable to sustain enemy occupiers, this was an area the NVA transited on foot while infiltrating farther south to more inhabitable places. The wasteland formed a major demarcation. North of here, all enemy supplies came via the Ho Chi Minh Trail. South of here, Most supplies came via secret shipments to the port of Sihanoukville. South of the wasteland grew triple canopy jungles where the NVA concealed major sanctuaries that paralleled South Vietnam's Three Corps region. The NVA and VC based 3 or 4 infantry divisions here, north and northwest of Saigon. One area with particularly heavy enemy concentrations where Cambodia protruded 10 miles into South Vietnam near Loc Ninh was called the Fishhook. It was in the Fishhook, U.S. intelligence learned, that the Viet Cong concealed their overall headquarters, the Central Office for South Vietnam, COSVN. A larger and more dangerous salient was the Parrot's Beak, which pointed dagger-like at Saigon only 30 miles away. Sitting astride the major Saigon-Phnom Penh highway, the Parrot's Beak open rice paddies and thin wood lines offered little concealment for base camps, so the enemy staged from there only for short periods, then slipped back north to havens in the Fishhook. Cambodian villages dotted the Parrot's Beak, making it all but impossible for SOG teams to move in daylight without being seen. SOG teams still reconned the Parrot's Beak when essential, but so risky were these politically sensitive penetrations that each had to be approved by the Joint Chiefs and State Department, sometimes even by the White House. Most Cambodian penetrations were in the Fishhook and Tri-Border area, northwest of Pleiku. It was against the latter that SOG focused teams in the fall of 1967, not far from where U.S. troops were drawn into the war's costliest confrontation yet, the Battle of Dak To. While the U.S. 173rd Airborne Brigade fought its way up the bloody slopes of Hill 875 southwest of Dak To, several SOG teams slipped into Cambodia, 5 miles west, to support the American paratroopers. Though, of course, this was so highly classified that not even the 173rd Commander knew of it. One such SOG foray led again by 10 Lowell Round Eye Stevens, this time with Sergeant First Class Ken Shoebox Carpenter as 1-1, walked into Cambodia from Seven Laos to search for a mysterious road supplying the enemy on Hill 875 and to learn whether the NVA was reinforcing or withdrawing. Stalking eastward across Cambodia for 2 days, Stevens' exasperated team searched high and low for the invisible road with no luck. It was during a noontime break the third day that Round Eye noticed the trees beside them seemed to form an odd pattern. "I stepped out on this thing," Stevens explained, "and I'm standing there, looking at trees and leaves on the ground, but there's something that isn't right about this place. But finally I see, it's a damned road. A road. And it followed the contours." Stevens and Carpenter found soft earth around the tree trunks, and looking up, they could see where the NVA had lashed together the highest treetops with vines. "This is unreal," Round Eye whispered to his partner. So unreal that he hesitated to report it. Positioning his men in an overlooking bamboo thicket, Stevens set up to surveil the strange scene. Just after dark, they heard the sound of distant truck engines coming their way, barely moving. About 10 p.m., several dozen men materialized like ghosts in the moonlight, silent, making no noise. The work parties lined up with bamboo poles, lashed them on either side of trees 18 inches in diameter, 10 coolies per side. It reminded Lowell Stevens of a movie about Egyptians building the pyramids as he watched the coolies heave up the trees and scoot them aside with little choppy steps, leaving a path just wide enough for a truck to squeeze past. A half hour later, the Green Beret NCOs watched an NVA truck convoy crawl past on the road's circuitous bed. As the Russian-made trucks headed toward Hill 875, they could make out rice bags and wooden crates of ammunition, but no soldiers. Clearly the NVA were resupplying but not reinforcing. About 4 a.m. the trucks returned. This time the cargo at first looked like heaps of tree limbs. But in the stark moonlight, Stevens got a better glimpse and recognized the protruding forms as arms and legs locked in rigor mortis, whole piles of NVA bodies frozen in death. Grim testimony to the 173rd Airborne Brigade's combat effectiveness and a sign that fighting on Hill 875 was nearly done. Just before dawn, the coolies returned with their bamboo poles, dragging and pushing the trees back into place. Finally, another crew walked by with sacks full of leaves, which they scattered to cover the truck tracks. By sunrise, the road was gone. That morning, Round Eye and Shoebox and their Nungs walked the camouflaged road, photographed its hairpin turns, and marveled at this feat of engineering. "It was magnificent to me how anybody could do something like that," Stevens said later. Just before noon, their point man unexpectedly stepped onto a trail and waved Stevens forward. As Round Eye began inspecting it, 4NVA walked over a rise 20 feet down trail. Stevens lifted his AK as he made out a long column beyond the four men, but only the tops of the others' heads were visible. When at last the NVA point man saw Stevens, he gasped, perhaps in a final introspective moment about the fatal stupidity of carrying his AK slung while walking point. Stevens let loose and dropped all four North Vietnamese. The rest of the enemy column was too shocked to react and did nothing. Stevens, Carpenter, and their four Nungs ran for all they were worth, with not a single shot fired after them. 5 minutes later, there were a few signal shots, but that was all. And what would the NVA think? What could they prove? Like most SOG teams in Cambodia, Stevens' men all carried AK-47s, so it was only spent Sihanouk cartridges that the NVA found scattered around their four dead comrades, while the SOG team escaped without a trace. SOG's Cambodia program had put Hanoi over a barrel. The enemy couldn't publicly protest SOG's presence without admitting their own illicit presence, and a private complaint to Prince Sihanouk would be an admission they couldn't defend their own sanctuaries. The NVA could do nothing except vent themselves on SOG teams, if given the chance. It was the State Department that generated most Cambodian political impediments, not the North Vietnamese. When former First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy visited the ancient Cambodian temples at Angkor Wat in 1967, the State Department had SOG halt its penetrations in hopes of a diplomatic breakthrough. When nothing came of it, SOG resumed operations into an expanded 20-kilometer depth, though the populous parrot's beak still required case-by-case clearance. Even if it cost the lives of an entire recon team, tactical air support remained absolutely forbidden. That fall of 1967 and into early 1968, SOG formally absorbed the 5th Special Forces Group's old projects Omega and Sigma, whose men, on loan to SOG, had been penetrating Daniel Boone targets. The teams were stationed at a new SOG base at Ban Mae Thut for missions into Cambodia and at Kon Tum for missions in both northern Cambodia and southern Laos. SOG's Da Nang headquarters, with FOBs at Phu Bai, Khe San, and Kon Tum, became Command and Control North, CCN. Its recon teams were named after states and snakes, for example, RT Anaconda or RT California. The Ban Mae Thut organization was named Command and Control South, CCS, and its teams named for tools, for example, RT Saw or RT Hammer. It was early in the new year, 29 January 1968, that SOG had its first Cambodia MIA, Sergeant First Class Charlie White, scheduled to rotate home in just 3 days. Operating in northeast Cambodia, his team had made contact, shot their way free, and made it to a tiny opening where ropes were dropped from a hovering Huey. A Special Forces medic, Charlie White was an enormous African-American, built like an NFL lineman, 6 feet 4 inches and 280 pounds. When he put his massive form into the extraction rig and the chopper started lifting away, he turned upside down, and about 25 feet in the air he fell out. Because of the many enemy soldiers nearby, nothing could be done that night to look for him. A bright light team with Sergeant First Class Fred Zabitowski and Dallas Longstreet III inserted the next morning, rappelling into the same LZ Charlie White was attempting to be extracted from. They found tracks where the NVA got in line and swept up the hillside, then discovered a place where all the tracks came together at one spot. There some bamboo had been crushed, apparently by White's fall. There was no blood on the ground. By the tracks, they determined the NVA had left as a single party, but the boot prints were too intermixed to determine whether White's larger tracks were among them. A full day behind, and the area was crawling with NVA. The SOG men couldn't even contemplate trying to follow them. Zabotofsky's bright light team was extracted. The Defense Department all but declared Charlie White dead, but Fred Zabotofsky, who had climbed that Cambodian hillside looking for Charlie, came out convinced the huge NWO had survived his fall and been seized by the NVA. What they did with him, we can only speculate, for Hanoi denied any knowledge of him. In the case of another Cambodia MIA, First Lieutenant Harry Krosky, Jr., we know exactly what happened. Krosky was one of a few Ban Mae Thot-based CCS officers running recon, and as 1-0 of R.T. Hammer, he soon acquired a reputation for audacity. When young Specialist 4 Brian Stockdale became his new assistant, Krosky announced, "I have a hell of a reputation for getting people killed." "Does that bother you?" Stockdale had not volunteered for Special Forces and SOC to evade the draft. "This is my kind of guy," the gung-ho trooper thought. R.T. Hammer was slated to recon the major NVA base area nicknamed the Fish Hook near the suspected Viet Cong headquarters, the central office for South Vietnam. Kosvin. They'd go in with just 2 Americans and 4 Nongs. After a few days' training, they took off from the SOG launch site at Bu Dop and inserted late in the afternoon. Their LZ was dangerously open grassland, so they hustled for the cover of a thick patch of jungle a quarter mile away. Once there, Lieutenant Krosky told Stockdale to make a radio check. While the young Specialist 4 set up, the 1-0 and his Nong Point man crept forward to examine a major trail they'd spotted from the air as they landed. Stockdale completed his radio check as the sound of their choppers faded in the east. Sunset was only a half hour away, and Stockdale thought they'd find a place to hide for the night, probably in this thick clump of jungle. Suddenly there was a quick burst of automatic fire, then another, then a hail of fire, all of it 50 yards away, where Krosky had gone with the point man. Stockdale pulled together the rest of the team just as the point man ran up amid even heavier fire. When Stockdale asked where Krosky was, the panicky point man shouted, "Lieutenant Feeney!" Stockdale may have been just an E-4 and new to recon, but he knew you didn't take an excited Nong's word, so despite the danger, he dashed forward to find Lieutenant Krosky. The Nongs were so petrified that not only did they fail to follow him, they ran off. The young Green Beret had dashed just a few yards when crackling bullets forced him to his hands and knees. AKs raked the earth around him. "The fire was kicking up so much dirt that I couldn't even lift my head up," he reported. Stockdale would later learn his 1-0 had walked up on 3 NVA, one of whom he wanted to take prisoner. Krosky shot 2 and waved over the third, but the last NVA jumped into the grass, fired wildly, and hit Krosky 3 times in the stomach and chest. Now, under heavy fire, the Specialist 4 managed to crawl close enough almost to touch Krosky's body, shouting at him to no avail. Then 4 NVA leaped up in the nearby grass and let loose with AKs. Bullets smacked the earth all around Stockdale, but miraculously did not hit him. He knew there was nothing more he could do. His withdrawal was almost cut off by a squad of NVA maneuvering around his flank. Then he heard shouts on 2 sides. Reaching the edge of the jungle again, he ran back to where he'd left the Nongs, but they were long gone, and the shooting, shouting NVA were right on his tail. Stockdale couldn't go forward because another group of NVA had outrun him and already turned to sweep back toward him. With NVA closing behind him, the Green Beret dashed in the only direction left, right across a wide field of shoulder-high grass, crossing it so quickly that the enemy assumed he was still in it as squads of NVA streamed right and left around it. Hiding just beyond them, in an island of thick jungle about the size of 2 football fields, Stockdale watched dozens of NVA form a cordon around the grass field. Then they set the grass on fire to flush him out or burn him alive. Though he tried repeatedly, Stockdale couldn't raise anyone on his radio. As the flames built, he could see the NVA watching the field as if they'd cornered an animal, and this was great sport. They didn't care whether they took him dead or alive, flushed him or burned him or shot him. Stockdale lay motionless, waiting for it to get dark, muffling his coughs as smoke drifted around him. Despite the shock of losing his team leader, the apprentice recon man rationally concluded he couldn't allow himself to give in to impetuous action. His sole chance was to outthink this numerically superior foe. It might be dark right now, he thought, but come morning, they'd sweep the area thoroughly and find him. He had to move. In the light of the dwindling flames, he could make out rows of NVA silhouettes sweeping the burned grass for him. Online, alert, AKs ready at port arms. Except for trying to raise someone on his radio, Stockdale lay there quietly, patiently, for 5 hours, until midnight. All the while, the NVA soldiers kept talking and maneuvering in front of him, with some even calling out in accented English, "G.I., we know you there." Another voice promised, "Come out, you die, you die." By now the fire had exhausted itself, and the scorched earth should have cooled and the enemy become less attentive, so Stockdale decided it was time to cross the burned field. He low-crawled the 100 yards of ash-covered ground, creeping so slowly and quietly that it took more than 2 hours. All the way, he heard voices and saw patrols pass within yards of him. But what most alarmed him were the NVA he spotted with flashlights, walking elbow to elbow, scouring the ground for any sign of him. Somehow, Stockdale made it between, around, and past many NVA, who'd grown so bold that they'd begun yelling, laughing, or even whistling. Once across the field, he scurried into a woodline, then crawled a few yards forward, until he found himself pinned between two converging trails with NVA voices on both. That was it. Stockdale was trapped. Despite his best efforts, he figured they'd find him. He'd put up a hell of a fight and that would be the end of it. 2 more SOG recon men vanished, another mystery to contemplate in the NCO club and to lie to families about. But not if Brian Stockdale could help it. Now, for the first time since the firefight, he heard a voice on the radio. His heart jolted. He fumbled to cover the handset so the nearby NVA wouldn't hear it. Just within range, Stockdale contacted a FAC putting in an airstrike back in South Vietnam and whispered his predicament. The FACs assured him he'd relay the message, to which Stockdale added a warning. "You'd better come get me at first light, or not come at all." The young Green Beret spent those final hours of darkness watching the burned field and the congregating NVA who awaited the dawn. Their shouts kept promising, "We kill you!" In the pre-dawn darkness of Ban Me Thot, 80 miles away, a unique U.S. Air Force unit, the 20th Special Operations Squadron, SOS, launched a half-dozen camouflage-painted Hueys to rescue the isolated Green Beret. With tail numbers removed and U.S. markings painted over, their only insignia was a stenciled Green Hornet on their tails, hence the 20th SOS nickname, the Green Hornets. Like the comic book character behind their masked identity, those top-secret Green Hornets, SOG's Cambodia flying unit, worked clandestinely for good. In fact, they were the only USAF combat unit flying Hueys in Southeast Asia. But before the Air Force helicopters could reach Stockdale, with daylight just cutting through the morning mist, the hidden Green Beret detected 2 NVA walking back and forth across the burned field. Then they froze, pointed to the ground, and shouted excitedly. They'd found his snake-like trail, where he'd crawled through the ashes the night before, and now they were pointing directly to where he lay hidden. More NVA came on the double. By now, Stockdale could hear the Green Hornets' whopping rotors, but there was no time left. He took careful aim and with 2 shots dropped both NVA trackers. There was hell to pay with what seemed to be a whole platoon opening fire. For a couple of minutes, young Stockdale fought an intense one-man defense against assaulting NVA, but before they could sweep over him, the Green Hornet gunships rolled in. It took 3 hours of gunship runs, with the birds rearming many times, before at last the Green Hornet troopship dropped the Maguire rig rope and harness through the trees, then lifted the Green Beret to safety. Harry Krosky's family learned of his death, even though his body was not recovered. And with a bit more seasoning, young Stockdale became the RT Hammer 1-0. He led his team with distinction for almost 2 years, establishing himself as one of CCS's most respected team leaders. The Green Hornets, as in Stockdale's case, were the prime reason a lot of SOG men came out of Cambodia alive. They had great esprit and really did some great jobs, said Colonel Jack Singlob, the chief SOG who arranged to have the 20th SOS reassigned from base security duties to SOG. The 20th SOS was SOG's only U.S. helicopter unit whose crews lived with the SOG men they supported. Although officially based at Camaran Bay, the Green Hornet birds and crews rotated every 10 days to the CCS camp at Ban Mae Thot, which did a lot for developing rapport. There probably was not another unit in Vietnam whose helicopter crews became personal friends of the men they inserted and extracted. The 20th SOS flew the F-model Huey, which, a 20th SOS pilot said, wasn't made for combat. It was made for hauling toilet paper and military policemen to missile silos in North Dakota. Though the F-model's turbine was fragile and a maintenance nightmare, it also generated considerably more power than Army Hueys, which meant it more quickly escaped hot LZs and carried more people, features well suited to recon operations. And unlike Army Hueys, which typically were piloted by 19 and 20-year-olds, these Air Force Hueys were flown by career majors and lieutenant colonels in their 30s and 40s, many on a final assignment before retirement. Half the Green Hornet Hueys were configured as gunships with rocket pods and unique hand-controlled miniguns. The latter proved extremely effective. Best damn gun system over there, CCS recon man Ben Lyons thought, because the pilots could focus on flying their aircraft while two gunners turned their 6,000 round per minute guns to meet the target. They fired during the approach, while passing the target, and even pivoted the guns to shoot backward after passing. When a Cobra gunship's minigun jammed, the Cobra went home for repair. If a Green Hornet minigun jammed, the gunner put on an asbestos glove, spun the barrels to clear it, then resumed firing, all in less than 10 seconds. The Green Hornet gunships pioneered their own tactics, too, especially firing techniques to exploit their handheld miniguns, like 360s. Hovering above a team, the pilot would spin his bird in a 360-degree pedal turn with both miniguns shooting straight down to form a circular wall of fire. I don't give a damn who you are. You're not getting through that, a former recon man said. One young Green Hornet troopship pilot, Lieutenant Jim Fleming, had a tough time adapting to this organization with its high esprit and firmly established pecking order. A swaggering lot, the gunship pilots thought themselves the chosen few. Knaves flew troopships, these knights of the gunships reminded him. It was the swashbuckling gunships that came in spewing lead and rockets to save the day. Then the second-class troopships, like airborne taxis, went in to pick up the team. At least, that's what the gunship crews liked to say. Worse yet, the 25-year-old Fleming was a lowly lieutenant in a world of 35-year-old majors and lieutenant colonels. Though elevated to aircraft commander, AC, after 5 months of combat flying, he may as well have been driving a dump truck, according to the gunship pilots. The rivalry irked the proud and skilled junior officer, though he said little about it. He just tried to do the best job he could. Any SOG team that a Green Hornet pilot inserted was his. That is, if he put them in, he pulled them out, with the four Green Hornet troopships dividing the teams among themselves. Even if a particular Green Hornet commander and his bird were scheduled to rotate back to Camran Bay, they'd not depart before extracting his team. It was only Fleming's second day as an AC that he was tested in a life-and-death contest. Flying with a new co-pilot, Major Paul McClellan, Fleming started his day routinely. That morning, Fleming inserted RT Chisel in Cambodian target Tango 51. There was no ground fire, so the recon men began moving quietly toward a wide river they were to surveil for enemy boat traffic. The Green Hornets returned to Duck Co, the small special forces border camp they'd launched from, refueled, ate lunch, then in mid-afternoon, another team climbed aboard and they flew far south to slip them into Cambodia. By now, RT Chisel had set up overlooking the river, lying in thick brush along a bend. Led by Staff Sergeant Ansel Sonny Franks, who'd run recon almost the year, RT Chisel included his 1-1, Sergeant Charles Hughes, and 3 Montagnards. They were accompanied by Green Beret Captain Randolph Harrison, the new CCS recon company commander, there to acquaint himself with what his men did. While the rest of the team improved camouflage, Sergeant Hughes erected a wire radio antenna to extend their range. It was barely set up when an NVA force hit RT Chisel. Hughes radioed for help, but there was no response. The inherent danger of a river watch mission, especially on a wide stream such as this, is that the position is untenable if detected. 1-0, Sonny Franks realized he was trapped. There was no place to go except the river, and he'd be cut down before they were halfway across it. Hunkered down in a small half-moon-shaped washout, they had decent cover, but couldn't hold out very long. By the growing fire, Franks could tell more NVA were arriving by the minute. The enemy had them surrounded on 3 sides, pinned against the water. The recon men set off a couple claymore mines, and that helped. But for how long? Hughes tried the radio again. 30 miles away, the formation of 5 helicopters was returning to Duck Co. after inserting the second team. Not one of the helicopters could hear RT Chisel's anxious calls for help. But flying higher in his Cessna 02 Skymaster, their FAC, USAF Major Charles Annenson, thought there was something familiar about a fuzzy transmission. Snapping off his other radios, he turned up the volume and, yes, it sounded like RT Chisel, but the signal was so broken up that he had to fly west before he could make it out. By now the NVA were thickly ringed around Chisel, peppering the bank above them with machine gun and AK fire. Sonny Frank's men narrowly beat back several assaults. Annenson's plane was close enough now for clear communications. By the time he'd located RT Chisel's position, the 2 Green Hornet gunships and 3 troop ships were arriving too. There was one big problem, though. After the long flight, they barely had enough fuel for anything but a quick pickup. First, they had to push the enemy back. Major Annenson directed the 2 gunships to make runs around the team. Green Hornet rockets and minigun fire were returned by heavy fire from all sides. Orbiting overhead, Lieutenant Fleming saw the gunships knock out 2 12.7mm heavy machine guns only 200 yards from RT Chisel. But the NVA filled the sky with such intense fire that one gunship shuddered, then its engine died, but its pilot, Captain Dave Miller, somehow landed the bird in a nearby clearing. As soon as Miller's skids touched Cambodian soil, a Green Hornet troop ship swooped in for the 4 crewmen. Already low on fuel, the rescue helicopter then headed straight for Duk Ko. Sonny Frank's men still held their horseshoe defense, but they were being pressed toward the river's swift, wide waters. They tossed grenades and blew more claymores. The Green Hornets had been overhead just 2 minutes, and already one gunship had been shot down, and another bird had flown away with the retrieved crewmen. Now a 3rd helicopter, another troop ship, was below minimum fuel and had to depart. That left just 2 helicopters, Jim Fleming's Huey and a gunship commanded by Major General Gonzalez. They, too, were dangerously low on fuel. The firefight surged around the cornered team, but they doggedly held on thanks to fire discipline and the cover of the riverbank. But 6 men couldn't hold out much longer against this large NVA force. Major Gonzalez's gunship rolled in and pickled rockets all around the team. He took heavy fire coming out, and Jim Fleming noticed him trailing smoke. Gonzalez's bird had been hit, though he thought the aircraft was flyable. Out of station time and almost out of ammunition, Fleming had to go in after R.T. Chisel immediately or fly away. No one would have said a word if he had announced his fuel was simply too low. Leaving made more sense than attempting a pickup with a Huey flying on fumes, but young Fleming had inserted R.T. Chisel. They were his team, his responsibility. He told the FAC he was ready to go in. To mask his approach from ground fire, the FAC led Fleming's Huey around a low hill, then talked him toward the river. Fleming banked so hard his rotor pointed almost vertically. Then he skimmed full throttle just above the water, running a gauntlet of AK and machine gun fire, while his co-pilot and door gunners shot at NVA and scanned for Chisel. He nosed the Huey into the bank where the team should have been. But just then the NVA hit RT Chisel in such strength that every recon man was too busy shooting to run for the bird. 1-0, Sonny Frank's mind flashed back to a nightmarish vision of a Green Hornet crashed into fire. Only weeks earlier, Franks and his team had braced themselves as the Green Hornet they rode smashed through treetops, broke apart, and burst into flames. The passengers and crew scrambled to safety, except one young Air Force gunner whose arm was pinned in the burning wreckage. By the time his desperate crewmates began hacking at his arm with their puny survival knives, it was too late. The 2,000-degree inferno pushed them away, and they watched transfixed as a living man, their friend, was reduced to ashes. The vision tore at Sonny Frank's guts. Then another NVA assault almost rolled right across the tiny team, and Lieutenant Fleming heard their radio operator scream, "They've got us! They've got us! Get out! Get out!" Fleming pulled pitch, backed away from the bank, and began climbing out. Not 50 feet away, one of the team's Claymore mines detonated, and the whole helicopter crew saw an NVA's body thrown in the air. Fleming radioed, "What's going on down there?" "We blew them back," Sergeant Hughes explained, "but we're out of Claymores, and we can't hold out much longer." Orbiting at a safe altitude, Fleming took stock of the situation. Their backs against a river too wide to swim and too open to rush across, R.T. Chisel could only last another few minutes. There was maybe an hour of daylight left, not enough time to get more helicopters or refuel at Duck Cove and return. Fleming radioed the FAC, "We'll give it one more try." The gunship pilot, Major Gonzalez, said, "I'll make one more pass over 'em, give 'em everything I've got, but then I've got to get out of here." Fleming fell in behind the gunship. Gonzalez swung low, salvoed his remaining rockets, and let those miniguns roar and groan until the barrels warped. At first, Fleming couldn't find the team, yet he knew he was getting close because the volume of bullets ricocheting across the water increased. Then the right door gunner shouted above his chopping machine gun's roar, "There he is!" And Fleming saw one Montagnard leap in the river, sloshing from shore as four men jumped in right behind him. Seeing all that fire, Franks thought surely the helicopter would be shot down or the pilot would pull out, but the Huey just came right over and hovered. Despite bursts of AK fire and exploding rockets, Fleming held that bird rock steady in what the Air Force later called a feat of unbelievable flying skill. Fleming's right gunner, Fred Cook, kept firing with one hand while pulling men aboard with the other. "Oh, I loved him," 1-0 Franks said of Fleming. "Every one of 'em there. There wasn't none of 'em flinching." From the cockpit, Fleming saw more NVA trotting and crouching along the riverbank. He could do nothing but hold the aircraft stable and warn his door gunners. His left door gunner, J.J. Johnson, was giving them everything he had. Then his gun jammed. Bullets shattered the Huey's windshield, and a bursting RPG anti-tank rocket raked the helicopter's skin, but Fleming held that bird level and snug up to the riverbank. "He was just steady as a rock," Sonny Franks said. At last, five recon men were aboard, but the last man, Captain Randy Harrison, wasn't there. With bullets slapping the water all around his helicopter, Fleming finally told himself that was it. They had to get out before a slug hit the turbine and dropped his Huey right there in the river. Even though he knew Randy Harrison best of all these men, he had to leave, or they'd all be done for. Taking up the collective, he began pulling back from the bank, and there was Harrison's face above the bushes as he sprayed fire at an unseen NVA a few feet behind him. The lanky captain ran 4 strides, jumped in the water, stroked twice, and Fred Cook managed to grab his hand just as Harrison snared a rope ladder. They lifted away, dragging the Green Beret captain in the water. AKs firing and rockets bursting all around. Then several hands heaved Harrison aboard, and Fleming catapulted them above the trees. 10 seconds later they were away, and it was peaceful again. Fleming and his co-pilot had been so focused they hadn't noticed their shattered windshield until air rushed in. The Huey's fuel gauges read empty when they landed at Duck Cove. After shutting down his engine, Fleming climbed out, took his helmet off, wiped the salty sweat from his eyes, and looked up at the slowing rotor. Suddenly, 2 big hands grabbed his head, and Randy Harrison shouted, "You sweet motherfucker!" then stuck his tongue in the startled Green Hornet pilot's ear. A couple months later, Fleming returned from R&R, only to be told to keep his bags packed. He was being shipped home 3 months early. Even the swashbuckling gunship majors and lieutenant colonels gathered round to shake Fleming's hand and congratulate this mere troop ship pilot. Fleming began to grow angry at the practical joke until the truth sank in, and he realized everyone was serious. First Lieutenant James P. Fleming's presence had been requested by the President of the United States. He'd been awarded the Medal of Honor and would be SOG's lone Air Force Medal of Honor recipient. The Green Hornet gunship pilot, Major Leonard Gonzalez, was awarded the Air Force Cross. "They were great people," says R.T. Chisel, 10 Sunny Franks. 7. SOG's Dark Arts. One Sunday morning in mid-1967, 4 North Vietnamese fishermen were working the calm waters near Hon Mat Island, 150 miles south of Haiphong, North Vietnam. As they strained to drag aboard their crude net, one fisherman stood, shielded his eyes, and stared to the horizon. Yes, there was a foaming white wake, glowing brightly in the midday sun and bearing down on them. The other 3 men looked too, and already the wake had segmented into 3 wakes, behind 3 distinct shapes, gray and close to the water, getting nearer by the second. In 5 minutes, 3 strange boats fanned out and screamed past, then one turned back, cut engines, and drifted alongside. A dozen Vietnamese men waved AK-47s at the fishermen, and all they could do was raise their hands. 2 strangers jumped aboard their boat. While one blindfolded and bound the fisherman, his partner announced in a North Vietnamese accent, "We are your brothers." The fishermen offered no resistance when they were herded aboard the strange gunboat, which got underway immediately. "We are your brothers," a voice shouted out above the roar of the engines. "The sacred sword of the Patriot League." What was this? Could it be? There had been many secret patriotic societies in colonial days, but they had been purged decades ago. And these men called them brothers, not comrades, as the communists did. Several hours later, the bound fishermen could feel the boat slow and sense they were in calm water. Then their captors ceremoniously pulled away the blindfolds, and what the fishermen saw made their heads swim. In a small cove stood an ordinary-looking North Vietnamese fishing village, except a bamboo stockade encircled it, as in the old anti-French Liberation War days, and over it flew not the North Vietnamese communist flag, but the large blue and white banner of what they had been told was the sacred sword of the Patriot League, SSPL. "This is liberated territory," their guide boasted as they pulled up to the dock. You are welcome here, brothers. Friendly people swarmed onto the dock and beckoned the new arrivals to share their dinner. And what a feast! Pork, shellfish, spring rolls, more food than they'd seen for 15 years. Then they all sang sentimental ballads. The communists had outlawed. The fishermen might have forgotten they were in North Vietnam, except Patriot League men walked guard and issued repeated warnings not to violate blackout rules. For 2 weeks, the fishermen did nothing but eat, talk about the old days, and learn about the Patriot League's liberation program. The League men knew all about corrupt Communist Party officials by name. It was a fresh breeze to hear such things. Even as the war raged around them, they learned the SSPL was organizing, recruiting, and insinuating their people into positions across the country. They boasted of other enclaves like this, and hidden camps in the hills, with some villages secretly controlled by patriots. They even had their own clandestine radio that broadcast almost every day. On their final night, the fishermen were talked to individually and given the names of SSPL contacts. Then they committed to memory secret recognition signals and meeting places and learned how to receive instructions via clandestine radio broadcasts. At the dock the next morning, each man was given a gift package of items in short supply in North Vietnam: fish hooks, thread, cloth, and the transistor radio. Then, as the whole village waved, the gunboat that had brought them cast off and, for security reasons, the crew again blindfolded their passengers. After watching the boat disappear from the dock, one Patriot League man walked back toward the village, but he bypassed the bamboo stockade and went on until he came to another cove, from which it was clear this was not the mainland at all, but an island. Ko Lao Kham Island. As any map of the Vietnamese coast discloses, Ko Lao Kham Island is well south of the 17th parallel, near Da Nang. And in the island's second cove flew not the Patriot League banner, but the Stars and Stripes, above a small SOG compound. It was all trickery. Operating as Project Humidor, the false village and the SSPL were the war's most elaborate continuing deception, conceived in SOG's Den of the Devious, the Psychological Studies Branch, OPS-33, the only U.S. element in Southeast Asia practicing those darkest of deceptive arts, black propaganda, vile, bold, often terrible lies that are falsely attributed. Patterned after the old OSS Morale Operations Division, Ops 33 operated behind such heavy security that few Americans in Asia had any idea of its existence, which was absolutely essential, since any trace of SOG's hidden hand would destroy a deception's effectiveness. No small-scale effort, SOG's covert propaganda operation had a 1967 budget of $3.7 million and a staff of 150, about half of them Vietnamese citizens, the other half U.S. military, plus a dozen CIA officers. The key to a successful black propaganda campaign was to develop a general theme upon which to hang all sorts of individual operations. As in any kind of deception, the SOG propagandists found, it was fastest, easiest, and most effective to reinforce what the enemy already believes or suspects, rather than try to convince him of something entirely new. For instance, since the North Vietnamese feared and hated the Chinese, black propaganda could aggravate these tensions. For example, SOG manufactured stories that Chinese troops in North Vietnam were romancing the wives and girlfriends of faraway NVA soldiers, implied that the Chinese were supplying poor-quality ammunition, suggested Peking was bleeding its Vietnamese comrades merely to send a political message to America. There was a grain of truth in each story, making them credible. An almost crippling limitation, though, was that the same U.S. policy that precluded establishing a resistance movement in North Vietnam prevented SOG from stirring up the populace to overthrow its communist government. There were some fine distinctions, however, because Sog was allowed to create a false or notional resistance movement, the Sacred Sword of the Patriot League. The Patriot League deception resulted partly from an analysis of what to do with the high-speed Norwegian nasty boats once American planes began bombing North Vietnam. The boats weren't needed for retaliatory raids anymore, and by 1966, the enemy realized SOG's coastal threat would never grow beyond pinprick strikes, so their diversionary effectiveness had declined too. Their great speed made the nasties a key contributor to Project Humidor, for they traveled so fast that the blindfolded fishermen miscalculated time and distance and believed they were still in North Vietnam. The operation on Koh Lao Kham Island, called Paradise Island by the Americans, was run directly by Ops 33, and like all its brainchildren, the technical touches were superb, from architecture to accents. The illusion worked. Along with lots of food, SOG fed their guests lots of false clues concerning conspiracies, secret agents, and saboteurs, to be passed along to the enemy counterintelligence officers who were certain to debrief them. SOG's experts interlocked these clues with other evidence, from phony radio transmissions sent to non-existent agents to secret instructions hidden in a fisherman's gift bundle, for enemy counterintelligence officers to discover and collate. On top of all this, SOG agent teams planted Patriot League leaflets along North Vietnamese roads and trails, while First Flight C-123s airdropped resupply bundles to Phantom resistance units. The harder enemy intelligence pursued these Phantoms, the more confused they became, for a while even suspecting the Soviets of being the Patriot League's secret sponsor. Though many fishermen undoubtedly were deceived, the links between the nasty boats and the U.S. were too well known. Yet North Vietnamese counterintelligence could not ignore Project Humidor because of its sheer scale. By 1967, SOG's Secret Island processed 27 kidnapped fishermen each month, and anyone or all might return as sincere spies or saboteurs. Integrated with Project Humidor were several other deception programs, the largest being SOG's so-called poison pen letters, which attempted to implicate North Vietnamese officials by inventing apparent evidence of espionage and disloyalty. Drawn up in Saigon, the poison pen letters were posted to North Vietnam from Hong Kong and places as far away as Africa and New Caledonia. In 1964, SOG was mailing 200 such letters per month, growing by 1966 to 500 per month. Most candidates were targeted solely because analysts found some means to incriminate them, which SOG accomplished using an extensive, sophisticated database that contained, say, a profile of the mayor of Vinh, or the name of a clothing shop facing the lagoon in downtown Hanoi. The scheme might involve sending the target a birthday card from Paris, perhaps with a microdot message hidden under the stamp, but it's not his birthday. Even if North Vietnamese authorities let him receive the card, and certainly he would not look under the stamp, his pseudo-instructions were so vague that surveillance would find his ordinary activities suspicious. Perhaps the most devilish double-cross ever devised was to examine a target's typewritten correspondence, have a micro-machinist duplicate his typewriter's distinctive typeface, then produce and post a series of incriminating letters that, enemy experts would attest, could only have been typed on his typewriter. The British Secret Service perfected this technique in the early 1940s and employed it to frame Nazi agents in South America. Another kind of poison pen letter was correspondence that was barely suspicious, such as an envelope with a Paris return address but a Hong Kong postmark, just odd enough to ensure that a censor would open it and sweep it with 6 brushes, each containing a different chemical solution for exposing hidden messages. To his astonishment, since he so rarely found anything, a secret message would materialize warning, say, that an agent had been arrested outside Hanoi, which SOG knew to be true, and the letter's recipient must prepare to continue the lost agent's mission. The message was just nebulous enough that counterintelligence could fit it into any pet theories or conspiracies they wished. To further incriminate the recipient, perhaps a few $100 were deposited in a Hong Kong bank in his name, or a bundle of gold coins given to a known double agent for him. Or maybe a fisherman kidnapped by the Patriot League was told, if he ever needs help, place a chalk X on a telephone pole that just happens to be across the street from the targeted official's apartment building. Most letters were much simpler, just correspondence that alluded to the recipient's anti-party criticisms, incriminating enough to put the recipient in a difficult position. Mere suspicion was enough to lock up almost anyone who, at the hands of a communist interrogator, was liable to confess and incriminate others. To the target's relatives and friends, each unjust arrest verified the regime's brutal character, setting off a chain reaction that spread through the entire society. The most obscure and potentially most controversial of SOG's black psyops was its secret funding of South Vietnamese anti-communist and pro-U.S. front groups, a small effort that cost about $100,000 in fiscal year 1967. Little has been disclosed concerning SOG's role with front groups, but it probably included the typical activities, sponsoring speaking tours for enemy defectors and massacre survivors, subsidizing conventions, underwriting printing and mailing of publications, and financing everything from rent to phone bills so useful organizations could disseminate their message. A less politically controversial SOG black psyop effort was the widespread forging of enemy documents, which were then fed back into the enemy's own distribution channels to confuse and manipulate him. Enough Viet Cong and NVA documents had been captured that the CIA's master forgers could replicate anything published by North Vietnam, right down to the exact papers, watermarks, and inks. To help SOG accomplish these frauds, the CIA maintained special catalogs of various North Vietnamese and Viet Cong officials' signatures, letter formats, code names, and bureaucratic jargon. Few of these forgeries would have had much effect if SOG, via its CIA connections, had not been able to insinuate them directly into the enemy's distribution channels, especially through the Cambodian-based Central Office for South Vietnam, COSVIN. In at least one case, U.S. media unwittingly reported the contents of false documents, unaware they were SOG's handiwork. In 1971, the South Vietnamese government gave U.S. reporters what it honestly thought were enemy documents captured in the Central Highlands that claimed floods had so devastated the North that Defense Minister Vo Nguyen Yap had ordered thousands of troops back home. SOG had planted these forgeries to cause NVA in South Vietnam to worry about their families and desire to return home to help them. Although Hanoi hollered long and hard that the story was untrue, the American press never realized the documents were SOG forgeries. A covert program of much wider influence was SOG's Black Radio, which was aimed at the ordinary North Vietnamese civilian and soldier. One North Vietnamese who defected in South Vietnam complained bitterly to American interrogators that the last straw came when Radio Hanoi repeatedly announced the names of students sent to Poland, Korea, and Red China for advanced study. This certainly was an injustice I could not tolerate. How could these privileged students be blessed with advanced study abroad while I was dying in this strange land unnoticed? Although there probably was a lot of truth to it, the Radio Hanoi story that pushed him into defecting quite likely came from No. 7 Hong Top Street, Saigon, SOG's top-secret black radio office. As was the case with so much in the secret war, black radio was limited by what the U.S. government would sanction. It was specifically forbidden to suggest the overthrow or destruction of the Hanoi government, though by definition black propaganda is not attributable. Despite these restrictions, SOG's black radio wizards were deviously clever. One program involved a supposed clandestine radio. Listeners were told the broadcasts originated in North Vietnam, and the radio had constantly to be moved to evade the North's security services, although it actually used studios and transmitters in South Vietnam. In mid-program, there'd be an excited shout or two, then, breathless, The announcer would explain that communist forces were approaching and the station had to close down. A few days later, he was back on the air, explaining how close a call it had been. In Project Jenny, a U.S. Navy EC-121 aircraft broadcast SOG radio programs while flying off the North Vietnam coast, a technique that confused enemy radio direction finders, and because the radio wasn't far away, it tended to overwhelm local station signals. SOG's primary black radio technique was called surfing, which means transmitting alongside a real station's frequency to capture listeners who mistakenly think they've tuned to the real station. Another technique was hitchhiking or coming up on the same frequency as the real station just after it signs off and using its call sign. Enemy intelligence realized SOG was playing radio games, but the goal was not to fool Hanoi officialdom, but to carve a chasm between the communist leadership and ordinary peasants and soldiers. These unsophisticated listeners were SOG's true radio audience, and by reaching them, SOG encouraged and exploited doubts, reduced efficiency, and undermined political reliability. SOG's greatest material limitation in these radio games was a shortage of transistor radios in enemy hands. The solution was simple enough. SOG built its own radios, codenamed Peanuts, which were CIA-designed and manufactured in Japan. Like anything having to do with Ops 33, the Peanuts radio was fiendishly clever. No matter how carefully you turned a Peanuts frequency dial, the real Radio Hanoi was lost in pre-planned static. But right there, just a hair away, and clear as a bell, was SOG's Radio Hanoi.